I'm Nika Sherrell, and this is The ItCast, real talk about all things sexual. Welcome to our first episode. With our mission to increase diversity in the discussion on healthy sexuality, we'd like to tell you a little bit about who we are.
Hello, my name is Dorothy Santos, and I'm the co-host for The ItCast. I'm a writer, editor, curator, and educator. I was born and raised in San Francisco, California, and I'm based here as well. Born in the late 70s, raised on murder mysteries with an early affinity to Liberace and Max Headroom, with La Misión as my playground. I was raised by an immigrant Filipino family. I identify as queer, and I'm attracted to unicorns and chimeras that shape-shifted into humans to protect themselves. I'm a sucker for intelligence and relentless spirits looking to change the world through revolutionary and radical love. I'm doing this podcast to help people feel seen and heard, and to promote healthier conversations regarding sex and sexuality. I'm doing this to end gender-based violence and help wake people up from their slumber. I look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.
I'm an artist, designer, poet, and dreamer. But most importantly, I'm a sex nerd. I love to study it. I love to research it. I love to talk about it. And occasionally, I even enjoy having it. People have been asking me questions about sex since I told my best friends in middle school that I started masturbating when I was 8. Now, for boys, that may not be so unusual. However, as a young lady in Kansas City, Missouri, or as I affectionately call it, the buckle of the Bible Belt, sexual exploration was frowned on. So when we had questions, we mostly asked each other. And the idea of shame around sexuality did not go away when I got older. In fact, the climate became more stifling as my peers began to have children, get married, and settle down. Yeah, I thought, I'd like those things too someday. But deep down, I knew that my image of an ideal family didn't match what I was seeing and being told was the right way to love. Born in the 80s and a child of the 90s, I was raised Southern Baptist Christian in a Black American home. Fortunately for me, my mother told me that if I ever had questions about sex, I could ask. And ask, I did. I wanted to know everything. And what she couldn't tell me, I looked up on my own. I had books and stacks of pamphlets with charts and diagrams. I now identify as gender fluid, which means that I move between both masculinity and femininity without bias to either nature. You can often find me in combat boots and cargo pants, working at a construction site with no qualms about hair or nails. And the next day, in a dress, painting in my studio, jamming out to Alanis Morissette, quickly followed by some Lil Jon and the East Side Boys, or Nelly. Either one, you pick. I prefer monogamy, though I date both men and women. And I believe that my sexuality is not defined by who I sleep with. My sexuality is defined by how I feel about who I am. And I believe that is true for all of us. I am doing this podcast to eradicate shame and fear around interpersonal connection, to promote healthier conversations on the topic of sex between parents and their children, lovers, families, and friends. The point of this conversation is to demolish rape, molestation, abuse, and victimhood, to increase sexual self-esteem, the ability to receive and experience pleasure without guilt or shame, and the occurrence of consent negotiations. Thank you for your listening, caring, and contributions. For our first show, Dorothy and I explored the topic of Valentine's Day. Taking a deeper look at love, we reviewed the book, The Five Love Languages by Dr. Gary Chapman, brought in special guest interviews with adult novelty store owner Nina Joyner, somatic psychotherapist Mama Lisa, as well as other professionals and community members sharing how they deal with intimacy, sexuality, shame, and ways to address trauma. So, Valentine's Day. A day some love, a day some hate, and a day some ignore altogether. For a day whose logo is a heart, it stirs up a lot of controversy. Why is this day so stratifying? And where did it come from? I thought about this as I considered what I had to say on the topic. When I was younger, I remember feeling really excited about this holiday. I thought, this is the day I finally get to tell that cute boy that I like him. Yeah, that went real well. 8-year-old boys are not so good at the easy letdown. And you'd think I would have learned my lesson the first time, but deep down, I'm a true romantic. Aside from disappointment, embarrassment, and shame, at least there was candy to soften the blow. So much candy. Honestly, my more cynical side prefers February 15th, also known as 75% off candy day. But enough about me. We wanted to know how you felt about Valentine's Day. Here's what you said.
I feel like a lot of American holidays are contrived, and they're put on us, and then we feel alienated, we feel isolated, we feel alone, separate, apart, less than, because everyone else is supposedly having a good time. But it's, I consider it like the Facebook syndrome, because on Facebook we think everyone's life is amazing, when in reality, those very same people are coming to me as clients, venting about how unhappy they are. And they're very selective on what they present. So similarly, with the holidays, it's a contrived, like, we should be celebrating love every single day of the year. There's no, like, it's arbitrary when that we choose. You know, it's an excuse to sell chocolates and flowers.
Now, Valentine's Day, man, that's... I don't know, I don't observe it because I'm single, but that's okay because it means beer and celebrating the anti-holiday of it. Any holiday is a holiday excuse to drink lots. If I get this opportunity to drink a bunch with the boys, it's just as good a memory as what you do for the traditions of Valentine's Day, going to get in the chocolates and, you know, get all desperate and you're like, I gotta find somebody for Valentine's Day and go to a movie or something to validate my manliness or my role in society or something like that. You know what I mean?
So what do I think about Valentine's Day? So it's an expensive day. It gets nowhere. And I just prefer to stay home because I hate dealing with other people, so yeah, I prefer just to watch a movie, and yeah, that's happy Valentine's Day for me. Yeah.
Valentine's Day doesn't really mean anything to me. It just reminds me of being young and passing out candy and cards, but nowadays it just seems like a day where you're expected to show love by buying chocolates, and it doesn't really mean much.
It's an invention that took place in Kansas City. And it happened because I believe some Art Institute students who went into making cards for people's holidays needed a new holiday. Hey, Valentine's Day! So it was a marketing concept. And it caught on and it stuck and we're here with it. This is what we do in the United States. We sell stuff. Other countries can make better stuff than us, but we can sell.
It's a Hallmark holiday. I don't really like it. It's great for florists and restaurants and card shops, but it puts a lot of people under this undue pressure. Whether they're in a relationship, then they feel like they need to meet their own or somebody else's, their partner's expectations. And if they're single, then Valentine's Day, for so many people I know, is just this really annoying reminder that they are, quote, alone. Yeah, I think it's kind of stupid.
So where did all this angst come from? Believe it or not, Valentine's Day may not be so Hallmark after all. Here's Dorothy Santos with the history of Valentine's Day.
Well, hello there, friend. So I've been thinking a lot about the history of Valentine's Day. As a matter of fact, I've been thinking much more specifically about its obscured history. Perhaps not that obscure since, well, the internet. Come on. The internet. You can find anything on the internet. Anyway, as I divulge to the team, I'm pretty obsessed with Valentine's Day. But it's a day that people really, truly seem to despise. Now, I don't love the day because of all the chocolate, cutesy cards, kitsch, and stuffed animals. The primary reason, really, is that it's an excuse to be much more extravagant with my love and affection towards the people I love the most. But I've loved Valentine's Day since I was a little girl. For the record, even the times I've been single, I've always loved the day. It's an excuse to make things, share things, and spread love. But there's a far more fascinating and awesome story of the origins of Valentine's Day. The pagan ritual, Lupercalia, comes to my mind. Think of the game Duck Duck Goose meets the dating game or Love Connection, then add blood. And I think I just dated myself because the dating game and Love Connection were both from like the 70s and 80s. They were dating game shows. Anyway, I'll post a link so that you can learn a little bit about more of that subculture of dating that was once televised. Anyway, let me explain Lupercalia. The Luperci, an order of Roman priests, would gather in a sacred cave where it was once believed that Romulus and Remus, the founders of Rome, once lived. The priest would sacrifice a goat for fertility and a dog for purification. The goat's hide would then be dipped in sacrificial blood and taken to the streets. Apparently, they would gently slap the women and the crop fields with the blood-drenched goat hide. The women actually welcomed the ritual and weren't fearful of it at all. They believed blood would ensure their fertility for the rest of the year. According to the legend of the ritual, the women would put their names in some huge urn that the men in the city, I reckon they were single, would then choose one name and be matched up with one of the women. It was believed that some of the matches would end up in marriage. Personally, I think goat hide and sacrificial blood splattered on bodies sounds a lot like a sexy erotic horror comedy. So take that, Tinder, Coffee Meets Bagel, OkCupid, Bumble, even though I met my person via Bumble, but that's pretty awesome, but that's neither here nor there, and I'm derailing. I digress. Anyway, I thought I would share a little bit about that history because it's hilarious that everyone thinks, oh, I hate Valentine's Day, it's a Hallmark holiday, I don't have anybody, blah, blah, blah. Well, first of all, I've never considered it a holiday, okay? Let's just get it straight. So that's one thing. But most importantly, and technically, the origins are far from Hallmark. So you're probably asking yourself, okay, why is it called Valentine's Day? I'll tell you why. First, I will say that Christianity sucks all the fun out of everything, and that's actually what happened, and probably the reason why people, number one, don't know about Lupercalia, and number two, believe it's a Hallmark holiday. Valentine's Day wasn't actually associated with love or themes of love. Around 2070 AD, the church deemed Lupercalia unchristian and made it a feast day. So there are three different stories. See, even Christianity couldn't decide on one solid story. So, one story was that there was a priest marrying young men and women, and marriage had been outlawed during the reign of Claudius II. He believed that having a significant other would hinder soldiers from fighting and being in combat. So that's one story. And that, and then Valentine was captured and became a martyr. The second story was that Valentine was killed for trying to help the Christians escape from Roman prisons. And then the last story was that Valentine was imprisoned. He sent the first Valentine to his jailer's daughter, hence the phrase, "From your Valentine." I mean, personally, I love the pagan story. The strange, the weird, and obscure facts make for some interesting dinner conversation, yes? Well, I think so. I hope you enjoyed all of this. There's a lot more to share, but I'll stop here. If I've piqued your interest and you want to learn more, visit our website or log on to our Facebook. I'll post links to the history of Valentine's Day and Lupercalia for you.
It seems to me that despite the true nature of where Valentine's Day comes from, we can all agree that it does have its challenges. Casting a yearly spotlight on how, when, and if we show love. 25 years ago, Dr. Gary Chapman tackled this in his book, The Five Love Languages. The book addresses five distinct ways that we can show and receive love. They are physical touch, acts of service, receiving gifts, words of affirmation, and quality time. After reading the book, I discovered that there's also a very helpful quiz you can find at thefivelovelanguages.com that will give you your results in about 10 minutes. What I love about this concept is that it applies to all living things that are capable of affection. Dogs love to spend time with their owners. And I once had a cat that was constantly bringing me birds and mice. Granted, those are all things she liked. Even though these are simple enough concepts, I have found that sometimes I have trouble speaking the languages. Opening our hearts can be a difficult process. Here are some insights on what the cause might be. I sat down with two mental health professionals to see if they could shine a light on why it can be challenging to give and receive love. Before we share what they said, here's a little bit about who they are. First, we have somatic psychotherapist Mama Lisa. Here's what she said when we asked how she culturally defines herself.
Southern born, Louisiana, a child of the slave trade, so of African descent. Sometimes I'll refer to myself as New African. I don't blink when someone refers to me as African American, and then I think most core to my identity is I walk through this world as a queer Black woman, as a song weaver and a priestess and a healer, a powerful healer. Both of those things call to me strongly. I know that my life is, and my hands and my heart are definitely in service to the divine feminine. I locate myself inside of supporting all things that help us reconnect to and realign with the divine feminine. Primarily, I move through the world as a community-based healer, predominantly as an emotional and spiritual midwife. I do a lot of work supporting the healing of trauma and transformation, supporting folks to be their best selves and their most embodied self inside of leadership and their purpose on this planet. I primarily do that work through my relationship with generative somatics. I have been a student on that path for a little over a decade and a teacher on that path for quite some time now, probably about 8 years. I began my journey in rape crisis work at San Francisco Women Against Rape, directing the counseling program there, and then fell across this body of work and just really appreciated the very direct in route of deeply being able to heal and transform trauma, which really appealed to me inside of that work and supporting survivors of sexual violence.
So what is this thing called somatics?
Somatics is fundamentally a path to transformation, is how we use it. The word soma, it's a Greek-based word in origin. That means the body and its living wholeness. So we're really looking at transformational work and healing work on the level of mind, body, spirit. I really look at this work as aligning our visions and our beliefs and the actions that we take and all of those things lining up. Often we roll through the world with great ideas and these beautiful values and desires, and then the actions that we take on the day-to-day don't always reflect and mirror those visions and those values, because our actions often get shaped by other things beyond the things that we care about and are important to us. But we're also very, we're permeable creatures, and we are shaped by our families and our communities and our cultures, historical norms, and so looking at how we get shaped by things consciously and unconsciously, and then how to intentionally shape ourselves towards being our best selves, being a open, clean channel so that divine purpose, essence can flow through us.
Next, we asked her to share some of her thoughts and opinions on the five love languages.
I first fell upon this when I was living in New Mexico, more than maybe 15 years ago. It was like, oh, languages of love, that makes so much sense. We all have are different languages of love, and we could be trying to love on each other, and if we don't speak the same language of love, here I am doing these things that I think is what it means to love this person, and they're not able to receive it or feel it. It's not feelable love for them, mm-hmm. because their language that they speak and receive is different. And then also recognizing that we can show love in certain ways that aren't necessarily always the ways that we like to receive love, mm-hmm. and how both how we show love, how much that gets shaped sometimes by our environment, mm-hmm. and how we grew up or the influences that were around us in our life journey.
Before the interview, we asked each of our therapists to take the quiz to see which of the five love languages stood out for them.
The two for me personally that were highest on the list were acts of service and physical touch. And physical touch did not surprise me. I know that that's something that's important to me. But the acts of service kind of surprised me to see that as coming out on top. And I think about our historical legacy, a shared legacy that comes out of the slave trade and our ancestors' experiences in slavery, and what service looked like. You were forced to serve and not dignified in the process. To stay and sustain love under the lash. Are there any cultural trends towards what comes out on top in languages of love? I think about some of those acts of service, especially for women, was the care of their children. The innocence of a babe, I could see. I have no arguments there about true, unconditional love being able to happen inside of those relationships. But where there is like a lack of dignity, I wonder if that was really love or something else. Something out of necessity that doesn't feel like the same place that love is born from.
Before we got to the next love language, I asked Mama Lisa to reflect on what might stop someone from being able to express love in a particular way.
We are shaped by the ways that we grow up, our intimate families, the families that we're raised with, and how we witnessed love being shown between those primary relationships, between mom and dad, between any siblings if you weren't an only child, between mom and your other siblings, and what you saw they got in attention and love, and what you feel like you got in attention and love. Then when you go to school, that can really shape what we anticipate. And then you throw in traumatic moments of violation or assault that happens, and especially when the violence is directly upon your body in a sexualized way where you did not have agency over, and actually physical touch was a dangerous thing in that moment. Your body was the site of the violation, and then those things get coupled. And our bodies can generalize in unconscious ways. Here's touch. And if that sexual trauma has left its remnants, and then benign touch can trigger something else that has happened. If you haven't worked through that or moved through that, it would make sense that someone is moving towards you as an expression of love in that way. And the very thing that they're moving towards to offer love is, I can't feel love in that way. Back off me. For me personally, I have an interesting, subtle, automatic move away in my body upon physical contact. For me, that's probably the product of being beaten as a kid in the name of discipline and spare the rod, spoil the child. So in my body, there have been moments, I have a godbrother who's so, so dear to me, Brother Marcus, and I think this was the moment that this lesson really, I could feel it on such a deep level. But I was washing dishes at the sink. It was at a time when I think he was across the country with his parents and we haven't been in the same location in a while, and he was here visiting. So it was just like, oh, such a beautiful reunion and special time together. And he moved to make this loving touch in the middle of my back. And my instant instinct was to just flinch away from the touch. And oh my God, it broke my heart, because in me, there is such a longing for physical affection. But what my body has learned is to flinch away from touch, born out of the physical abuse in the disguise of quote unquote discipline, the physical abuse that I received on that level. And just, and that moment was like, I want his love so much. And then my body is like that moment of contact where my body flinches away. There was just something about that moment for me that was so disorganizing in a beautiful way, a really insightful way. It just has you really evaluate how the pressures of life can often have us adapt away from what our truest nature is.
Here on the ItCast, it is our mission to create safe audio space. Because we touch on a lot of sensitive subjects, we respect everyone's right to privacy. The following is an anonymous submission from a marriage and family therapist working in California.
I am a white Caucasian male, sexual preference straight, and I'm polyamorous, so I'm in open relationships and I don't have a primary.
Next, we asked if he could tell us just a little bit about what polyamory means.
Polyamory is defined depending on what your background is and how you approach it. Some people consider it an excuse to just sleep around and have multiple partners. Other people joke that it's just people who are afraid of making commitments. Whereas for me, I am in a conscious, intentional relationship where my partner and I, we both are in open relationships, and we are private about those relationships to protect the other person. So what stays in one relationship doesn't also get involved with the other relationship. And it helps keep it clean and respectful. The word polyamorous can mean something to you very different than what it means to me. It's just like a quantifier to help people relate to, like, oh, a way of life, you know, your sexual preference, your sexual lifestyle.
Here's what happened when he took the quiz.
My primary is quality time. I scored the highest on the online quiz with quality time, and that doesn't surprise me because that is my go-to. It's just effortless to gravitate towards defining love reciprocity with how we are spending authentic, present, moment-to-moment time together. Yeah, I was surprised how many times they keep asking about gift-giving in all the ways that we express gifts, whether it's through words, whether it's through material objects. And I was noticing how much of a visceral reaction I was having. I was very off-putting. Like a lot of resistance towards that. And that also speaks to probably my upbringing and development. Oftentimes our wounds, our old hurts growing up, where we felt a denial of love, that's where as adults we tend to avoid those areas of receiving love because it's just too painful. It opens up our raw, vulnerable, exposed selves. And so we gravitate towards replacement love language, when actually what we really want is that form of love. But it became tainted. It became had a negative connotation associated with it, because every time you experience that love reciprocity, that form of language, love language, then it's like you siphon back to those feelings when you were young, where love was given in that way, but it actually meant harm. It was hurtful. Trauma can actually disrupt and stifle like your soul's natural calling, your soul's natural evolution, you know, your authentic true self. It actually gets thwarted and becomes something else. It's almost like a vow. Like when you get hurt, and this is all happening unconsciously in our psyche, but we vow never to be hurt in that way again, never to put ourselves at risk again, never to be vulnerable again in that way. And so we find other strategies, other means to get our needs met that might not actually be true to ourselves. It's like a false will. It's like a false pursuit of something that isn't aligned with your highest good, your highest self. So perhaps when you were young, and I'm gonna give you an example here, like maybe your mother is a hoarder and you had a propensity to enjoy gifts and you enjoyed receiving gifts and giving gifts. However, because it was so much unhealthiness, conditional love wrapped up in that growing up with your primary caregiver being your mother, then the result is it actually might leave a bad taste in your mouth. It might lead to resentment, anger, hurt, frustration. And so why would you want to continue, you know, gravitating towards gift giving, receiving as well, if it's going to bring up those kinds of painful feelings?
So elaborate on conditional love.
Using the example I was just going on around hoarding, the mother who hoards, if you like break it down, it's actually like a measurable love, because when you're giving gifts and that's the primary go-to love language, then how expensive of a gift, how big of a gift, it becomes this competition. And then if you're being given a gift and you don't give a gift of equal value in the eyes of the giver in return, then it becomes like a competition and a tit for tat. And again, like that ruins the spirit that perhaps your true authentic self would have brought towards that love reciprocity of what a gift means to you. But unfortunately it gets tainted, because that's where the trauma comes in. Because for your primary caregiver, your mother, for her there's all of these, I don't wanna pathologize by saying the word unhealthy, but it is unhealthy in the eyes of the person who is traumatized by it. For them, it becomes an unhealthy experience where the only way through is to have boundaries. And again, a lot of these boundaries happen in our subconscious, unconscious mind. So the psyche takes on protective measures, like a form of a vow, that will prevent them from ever having to expose themselves to that raw, vulnerable place again. And what it really, what I'm trying to say is that you're protecting your younger self. The younger self doesn't know any better, even though you're an adult in an adult body doing adult things.
How do we know when trauma is present?
The young self is still constantly, it's kind of like if you think of a village, we have all of these ages inside of our brain, inside of our psyche. And they're constantly, you know, vying for our attention. And if we're not aware of approximating which age is talking in a given moment as we're reacting to a given situation, then we're just a reactive, like I call it, like a soap opera reactive existence. And unfortunately, in my experience, most people are living out that life, the soap opera reactive existence, instead of a mindful, conscious, you might say spiritual experience.
So how does past trauma affect our current relationships?
Where you're aware of what's happening, you're in relationship to who it is that's communicating with you, which age, which younger self, and then you have a dialogue with that. So instead of them using and running the show, you actually can talk sense to the younger self who didn't know any better. They were young, impressionable, fragile, susceptible. How you know trauma is present is the more often that younger self makes their presence known, the more often you hear that voice coming up in reaction to situations, the more likely that's pinpointing towards a traumatic episode, a traumatic experience. An episode could be a period of time, or it could be an isolated incident, one experience, one moment in time. But either way, depending on the impact of that trauma and the severity of it, it can have wreak havoc on your life for many, many years, and perhaps till your deathbed if you don't work on it and bring awareness to it and get healing from it. The way that trauma works is it's a disruption of a natural evolutionary process. So as we develop at age-appropriate times, the development can get stifled or disrupted because of trauma. And when that happens, from that point moving forward, we unconsciously seek out like situations, like partners, like circumstances to provoke the same experience seeking resolution, seeking healing from it. It was a loss of power. That's what trauma is at its core. It's a loss of power, and you are trying to regain that power by seeking similar partners, similar circumstances, similar situations. And the unfortunate reality, though, of that strategy, that approach, is it's inherently doomed, because what happened to you, by who caused the trauma, that hurt that was caused can never be undone in the way that it happened. You're never going to be as young as you were, and that person who did it at the time is never going to be who they were at the time that they did it. And so the only way that you can get resolution from it is to recognize that you were a child back then. That part that was hurt will always feel that hurt. Unfortunately, there's no way to get beyond that part of it, but you can change your relationship to that hurt inner child's need to get resolution. You can calm it. You can self-soothe it. We call it coping strategies in psychotherapy. So we can develop inner resourcing or external resourcing, places that we can go to that are safe, friends that we can talk to, activities that are self-soothing and calming that help us feel grounded.
How do we keep trauma from becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy?
There's no right or wrong approach towards healing trauma. It's just the modality that best matches your interests, your values, what resonates for you. Yeah, it's a very personal experience. That's why, in my experience, you'll see clients moving from therapist to therapist, spending a fortune trying to find the right match, because that is really key. It's not just about finding the modality that best fits your interests, that best fits your comfort, safety, trust, but it's also about having a practitioner that you also feel that safety, comfort, and trust with.
This is the ItCast, and we promised you something sexy. So far, we've talked about all the other ways we can create connection. Now, let's talk about sex. We interviewed Nina Joyner on location at her store, Fillmore 510, adult boutique and gallery in downtown Oakland. They just celebrated 6 years in business on Valentine's Day. Congratulations, Nina. As usual, we begin with a cultural definition.
I would define myself culturally as an African-American, masculine / female identified person. So, genderqueer.
My preferred gender pronoun is they. I also use him. I am 42. I love my gray hair, my little gray patch. It's definitely hereditary, but my family seems to have that thing going. I'm originally from Las Vegas, Nevada, moved to the Bay Area in 1994.
So why open a sex store?
I got up one day from a dream and decided this is what I wanted to do, and I was actually having breakfast with a friend this morning, and she remembered me selling porn, selling novelties, walking around bars, and doing things like that.
I was amazed the first time I heard Nina say the words, "I don't believe in bad sex." Now that I had the opportunity, I was curious to know how one gets to that level of understanding.
Who I am as a person has brought me to the understanding of sex, that sex is ever evolving. There is no end point or there is no success to sex. Sex is ever evolving, so how I look at sex is It's like a book. Yeah, you read it, but then you go back and you pick out the good parts, and then you have some not so great parts, and then you use it as a reference model. Then when you read the next book, you have something to base it on, like if it was good writing or if it wasn't great writing. You'll see punctuations, you'll see things out of place, but then they make sense to you, or things that just don't make sense right then and there, and then several years later they make sense. Who I am as a person has brought me to the understanding of sex, that sex is ever evolving. There is no end point or there is no success to sex.
The first time I entered Fillmore 510, I knew that there was something different about this place. With a chill, laid back atmosphere, I didn't need to feel concerned about the sketchy arcade next door or who might be in there doing what. I didn't feel the need to quickly make my purchases, jam my bag into my purse, and walk out nonchalantly, like I hadn't just been in there dancing on the devil's doorstep with a Hell's Angel at the register. I wanted to know how she set herself apart.
The success of all of this has just come from wanting it to be different, especially for people of color. Their issue with learning about sex is around trauma. We're talking about sex from the perspective of trauma versus the true origin, which is to be peaceful. It's supposed to be connected. It's supposed to be, you're supposed to be one with yourself if it's just masturbation.
So why is trauma an inroad for learning about sex, particularly in marginalized communities?
We have laws in this country, but they don't really protect us. They don't protect people like they say they do. You would want someone who has been an aggressor or an abuser to be, I wouldn't say punished, but held accountable. That is where a lot of the non-growth, the pain that comes along from trauma abuse survivors is, how do I have this person to be accountable? Even after you're an adult, the law is to be your parent, and they're not that. They're failing you just like your parents failed you when the trauma happened. And I believe that people really want to experience a lot more than what they're experiencing around the legality of things. And with sex, we're supposed to be connected with someone. We're supposed to have fun with it. And I think a lot of times in brown communities, we run the risk of a high percentage of time than other communities learning about sex through trauma versus through pleasure, where, you know, I had a parent that came in here and she wanted to talk to her 14-year-old daughter about sex. And she was like, well, what can I get her? You know, and I was like, well, get her what you've gotten. You know, what you just got was a great example of something that you can get for your daughter. And now you and your daughter are best friends, quote unquote, because now she has a reference point to talk to, you know, to talk about this product with. But I don't have brown families coming in to ask that, and maybe they just aren't asking that, and maybe I'm just singling out and saying it doesn't happen, that's not the case, but I just hear from a lot of friends online, and it's just like, that's a trigger, like, you know, we got all these words, like, oh, that's a trigger for me, and it's just like, well, when are you going to get over it? It's just like a parent, when a parent doesn't do well for you in raising you, what do you do as an adult? You pick yourself up, and you learn how to parent yourself, and so it's like, I've gone through trauma myself, and I've had to do the work of what I wanted my parent to do so that I don't keep saying those same stories. So I think that's where we are, and I want to be a good example of those great examples that are out there maybe people don't have access to. It's not just about people of color. I think, you know, a lot of the writers out there say, oh, it's a person of color shop. Well, there is no person of color shop. This is a space that is welcoming and intentional to make that community feel at ease when they're met with this information. It's also the same place that has welcomed traditional buyers for generations. And so we want to continue to do that. And we're also having a shape-shifting exercise in how do we talk about sex? How do we present sex here? What do we do? We're very non-traditional in the sense that we just make you feel at home. You know, it would be like coming into your grandmother's house without your grandmother here. You can sit there and talk about whatever you want to talk about, and you're not getting a lecture, and you're not being told, no, you can't do that. I'm like, it's your money, it's your body. However, this is the information I want to make sure that you have. And people feel okay with that. I think people just want to feel validated. When people are purchasing, it's about validation. It's not about shaming. It's about what does that person need, and making sure that they get their needs met, you know, when they come in here for a certain product. finding out, okay, now what is it you want to do? Because sometimes they get information, oh, my friend has this and she said it's great, I should get it. But it's not like a pair of shoes. It's not like a cute jacket. It's not like a haircut. You can't see it. It's something that is in your neutrons, your protons, your atoms. It's in your heart. Mm. It's in spaces that you have to believe exists, mm-hmm. but that you can't see with your eye.
So remember when I said my mom said I could ask her anything? Well, here's an awkward moment in the life of Nika Sherrell. I asked my mom to take me to an adult novelty store for my 18th birthday. Her reply, why don't you ask your cousin to take you? But to her credit, she got over it and we had a blast. This month's question was, how do you love yourself? I'm discovering that when I show love authentically to someone, I'm also showing love to myself. If I don't love myself, I can't love unconditionally. And it takes being able to receive love to stand in the presence of it. Often we block or ignore our own needs for love for the needs of someone else. Children, parents, romantic partners. We can emote love actions without actually connecting to the presence of love. I discovered that that kind of behavior breeds resentment. So now, I love myself by staying present to the love that surrounds me each day and let go of the safeguards of resistance. That's how I love myself. So, community, what say ye?
Keeping a piece of your time and your life for yourself is self-love. Including yourself in the rotation of your love and your caring.
How do I love myself? I guess I'm kind to myself. I forgive myself. When I screw up, I cut myself some slack. And I try to remember, I guess, that the most important relationship I have is with myself. Yeah, and it also means occasionally loving myself, means shopping in Anthropology and getting a massage.
Well, my favorite is actually mirror work. We all have a mirror accessible to us, probably in our bathroom at least, if not behind our bedroom door. And I try to spend at least 10 minutes a day in communication with myself. Some people call it positive affirmations or declarations where you say, I love myself, you know, you're good enough. And that could be valuable for some, but for me, I actually have a present moment-to-moment conversation. And it's like I become split personality. It's like two parts of my psyche are in communication with each other. And I can go very deep and I can sort out lots of profound obstacles that are challenged within my life. It's just a way that I help ground, and no one knows us best like ourselves. Something I say to a lot of my clients is, you're the expert on you. So it's not my place to judge or assume or give advice on what's best for you. You know what's best for you. So who better to talk to than yourself?
Who better to talk to than myself? Don't get me wrong, I love mirror work, but sometimes we need a little interpersonal connection too. Here's Dorothy Santos with the skinny on some of our modern dating practices.
It's 3 a.m. and you're having a sleepless night. You can't work or read anything online because your brain is just not functioning in that particular capacity. If you don't already have a Tinder profile, you go ahead and create one. It's something for you to do. You're bored, but you want connection. Either way, creating your profile becomes an awkward exercise of the ego and modesty, or witty self-deprecation and vulnerability. But it wasn't always like this. In Maura Weigel's book, Labor of Love, The Invention of Dating, she does a fantastic job of taking us through the history of, you guessed it, dating. Her writing and research looks at gender performativity and the ways economics, culture, and political climate dictate the way people dated and still date. She also includes a good dose of LGBTQ history in Labor of Love. Here's a little fact from the book. Apparently, in 1896, the first instance of the word dating in media was used by writer George Ade in a column he wrote for the Chicago Record of his observations of the lives of the working class. This led me to think about how gender norms were created and perpetuated. Men have always, in many cases, still make way more money than women. Gender inequality has certainly shaped the way people date. One of the funny metaphors Weigel brings up is dating being a lot like an unpaid internship. There's so much truth to that. Yet, there's also culture and family to take into account and how these factors play a huge role in the way we participate in the larger scheme of dating. There are still analog ways to meet people, through friends, or even meetup gatherings, but let's face it, there are many people that still believe in the binary gender normativity that women ought to be chaste. But what about queer trans women of color and people of color? How do they navigate romantic relationships and dating online and in physical spaces and places that weren't originally created for them? Historically, a lot of dedicated spaces have been created to address this, but it's still very important to recognize. I think that's one of the reasons why mobile technology allows a type of accessibility and even gamification to socialization. Okay, dating. Now, I can't talk about dating rituals without bringing up a recent article published on Valentine's Day. Actually, really well-timed. On the Daily Beast, with the headline, "The First Black Bachelorette, Rachel Lindsay Breaks a Ridiculous Color Barrier." Aside from being a sensational headline, after 14 years, that's 33 seasons, of predominantly white men and women, there's finally a black bachelorette. Full disclosure, I've never seen an episode of the Bachelor franchise, so I won't speak to it in great detail. But I felt it was important to mention because primetime television serves the general public. And after 14 years, the majority of American public is still fed a specific way that dating ought to look and feel like. For the record, I've never, ever in my life worn a gown on a date, and I only know that gowns are worn on these dates because I forced myself to watch one of the trailers of last season's The Bachelor. Unless you count a prom dress, and that doesn't count. Anyway, reality dating shows have been around for a while. The Dating Game, where three bachelors are behind a wall and a bachelorette asks questions and blindly selects a contestant based on their answer to her questions, was first televised in 1965. All this being said, while many people I've spoken to claim that they don't like dating, as a culture, we sure like consuming media about dating and romance, no matter how it's packaged. So let me pivot towards contemporary dating rituals, if I can even say that there are rituals and they exist. Online dating sites like eHarmony, Match, and mobile apps such as Tinder, OkCupid, Coffee Meets Bagel, Bumble, Hinge, Grindr, and the list goes on, mediate our identities to a certain extent, but also allows a type of weeding out process that is immediate and may be helpful for folks interested in something long term, or not. In the fall of 2015, writers Alicia Eller and Eve Pazer co-wrote an article titled How to Win Tinder, and one of the most striking things they wrote that speaks to our digital life and engagement with our smartphones and how it's become ritualistic really resonated. So let me read you that excerpt. "Tinder playtime takes over the time of solitary relaxation, self-reflection, and decompression from the day's events. It is often played in transit, on a bus or train, times otherwise reserved for reading or texting or watching TV. I actually Tindered while watching my favorite show and while having a conversation with a friend. Those narratives fading in favor of fragmented ones with a stream of strangers." It's funny when I think about the term rituals in relationship to dating, because I think we all engage in habits that work for us to get us to a desired outcome. But I can't really say I believe in rituals anymore, to be honest. I definitely agree with Weigel. Economics, culture, and politics really dictate the way we connect, date, have sex, and find love. Just the other day, I saw a friend of a friend express on social media her disappointment when she found out that the person she was wildly attracted to and had a crush on is a Republican. Insert flushed, big-eyed emoji face right here. I will say, when I'm the only one on the train that is looking at everyone else looking at their phones and swiping up and down, left and right, a part of me wishes we could remix dating rituals or rethink the way we connect. Yet how do we remix the painfully stereotypical romantic scenario of, "I saw her standing across the room"? By the way, I'm addicted to how we met stories, but that's a whole other episode. Anyway, before I go, do you have rituals? What are they? How would you re-envision them? Nika and I would love to hear your stories. Till next time, take care, be well.
You can listen to the ItCast monthly for more real talk on sex. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, and join the discussion group at the ItCast. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the person who shared them and do not necessarily reflect the official position of the ItCast or its producers. You can follow Nina Joyner on Twitter at Fillmore510. Learn more about Somatics at www.generativesomatics.com. For a full list of resources referenced here, please go to our Facebook page, The ItCast, Real Talk About All Things Sexual. Follow me on Twitter, at Nika Sherrell.
Music for this episode was contributed by Marion Beats, Danger Bell, D-Tunes, Chris Allery, and Ryan Dennison.
The ItCast is produced each month by co-host Dorothy Santos, senior producer Christine Trudeau, associate producer and community outreach manager Anissa Driver, the twins, Melanie and Melora Green, and me, your host and creator, Nika Sherrell.